Hi, I'm Diane Shannon. I'm an internal medicine physician, award-winning writer, and certified coach. I learned the hard way about the cost of burnout, and in the 20-plus years since, I have dedicated my life to addressing physician burnout. I run a coaching company where I help women in medicine navigate the stresses inherent in the profession and the additional challenges that they experience. Join me as I investigate the underlying causes of the higher burnout rates in women and what we can do about them, individually and collectively. We can banish burnout and thrive as women in medicine. Welcome to this episode of Vital Signs, Thriving as a Woman in Medicine. Today, my guest is Dr. Jessica Dudley, who is Chief Clinical Officer at Prestgeny, where she works to support healthcare organizations to increase clinician engagement and workforce well-being. Her areas of expertise include leadership development, clinical care redesign, and addressing clinician burnout. I met Jessica at a professional conference about 2 years ago, where I was intrigued by her presentation of survey data related to the causes of clinician burnout and gender disparities in burnout rates. Jessica, I am so looking forward to our conversation and learning more about the underlying drivers of burnout today and what individuals and organizations might do to support clinician well-being and engagement. Welcome, Jessica.
Diane, thank you so much for having me. Thrilled to be here and really appreciate the attention and time that you're spending raising more awareness about this issue, about the challenges facing female physicians. And I'm even going to go with female clinicians, probably including APPs as well. And then really focusing on solutions, like what are we going to do? Because we both finished medical school a long time ago. And the fact that we're here talking about this even today, when at least my class was 50% female, just kind of emphasizes we've got a long way to go still.
Yes. Thank you. Glad you're here. I want to start with a warm-up question. And I know that you live in the greater Boston area also. What is your favorite month here?
Okay. So I'm going to go with June. That's my birthday. It's not too hot. It's not cold. As I've gotten into my older years, I don't like being super hot. I used to be cold my whole life, but that's changed recently. So I love June. June in Boston is beautiful. It's not hot, but it's sunny and it's light out late and beautiful time of year to visit Boston.
I also have a June birthday and June too, for the same reasons. So let's dive in. What is the challenge? What is underneath those disparities in gender in terms of burnout rates for women clinicians?
Sure. And I'm going to like shift us a little bit. So let me share just a little bit of like my, you mentioned I'm at Prestgeny and I had been previously actually at Brigham and Women's for 25 years. And I'm a primary care physician by training. And I first kind of got focused on this area of the discrepancies when I was still at the Brigham. So I was the chief medical officer for our physicians organization. And it was becoming increasingly clear, this was back in 2016, that all of our physicians were struggling and feeling honestly like they were being asked to do more and more with less. And that maybe the rules had changed a little bit. And the whole country was having an awakening about burnout. And lots of folks were really beginning to recognize that this wasn't just going to go away and it had to be addressed. And in that time frame, we surveyed our docs at the Brigham. And when I looked at the survey data, I was pretty stunned. Because there was a very big difference between our female physicians kind of reporting rates of burnout versus what we were seeing from our male physicians. And it was independent of specialty. And we had a female CEO at the Brigham at the time. She was actually the first female CEO. And I think this is important as we think about like solutions and addressing some of these challenges, one of them is having more women in leadership roles, because to our female CEO's credit, she actually was very intentional, and we appointed three female chairs during her tenure there. And prior to that, there had not been a single female chair. And so when I ran this data and found this discrepancy, Dr. Betsy Nabel was our CEO, and I shared it with her, and she said, this is unacceptable, and we have to really lean in and address this. And I really appreciated that. And I would say the female chairs, there were two female chairs at the time, there's now three, they too were concerned about it. But honestly, so were the male chairs. So this was kind of globally, the leadership said, we have a huge percentage of our workforce that is women, and to see that they are doing so much worse than our male physicians, this is indeed an issue. And even though everybody's burnt out, it is so much worse for the women, and we need to understand why and address that. So I'm sharing this with you because having leadership support is really important. And it can't just be female leaders because there aren't enough of them. And we absolutely need the male leaders to acknowledge that this is an issue too. Go ahead.
Can I ask you a question there?
Yeah, sure.
When you first saw those discrepancies, did you initially have a reason that came to mind? Like, oh, this must be because women XYZ or men XYZ, that's different in how they move through their careers as physicians?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I would say it's hard to remember back to 2016, 2017, but actually the survey was in 2017. So that's when we saw the data for the first time. I think that so I know what it's like because I am a female physician. So I had some sense of what was probably driving this. But once we had the data, this initial survey data, we then went on a deep dive effort to better understand it. So it's hard for me to kind of completely separate what I thought versus what I learned. But I know that I did think, just from my own experience, that a major driver was all of the things that women do in their non-professional jobs that I think really do add to things that we now have language for, like cognitive load and burnout. And I would think about I've been married for a very long time. I have three kids and I'm a very kind of engaged spouse, but I still was the one who owned all of the kind of making sure kids got to doctor's appointments. If there was something happening at the school, I would be the one who called. I was the one who worked and managed the nanny. So this kind of second shift is one of the terms people now use. I was well aware that I was kind of owning, not across the board, but for the most part, the female physicians that I knew kind of owned more of that than their male partners. And I thought that that was kind of a big contributor to this kind of second shift. What I learned is it's far greater than that. And we certainly now, thank goodness, have many, there's many couples in medicine where the male partners are actually playing a much bigger role in kind of presence at home in that second shift space. And so that is not the only issue. And I helped, meeting with different sets of physicians and spending a lot of time thinking through this and going deeper in the data, we learned a number of things. So I would say, and this is kind of off the top of my head, but then I left and I went to Press Ganey, which we'll talk about in a minute, which enabled me to go much deeper into the data to actually really, really understand what the differences are. So when I was still at the Brigham, three things that we discovered from looking, going deeper in these focus groups and really talking to folks was it landed into kind of three big areas of flexibility. And that has remained a theme. And I would say that's one of the biggest important things, advancement and respect. And those were the three areas that we landed on when I was at the Brigham for an academic workforce. that really felt very different. And the experience that female physicians were having in those areas were much different than those of their male colleagues.
Can you give an example?
Sure. So, let's start with, so I said flexibility first, because I think that that's actually a hugely important one, and maybe one that people really can do something about. And I actually think the need for flexibility is far greater, I think, because of the second shift stuff for female physicians. And I think COVID has helped advance the importance of a more flexible schedule than what we had before COVID. So flexibility could mean either hours that you are in clinic. So a lot of times we try to have a very 4-hour session in the morning, 4-hour session in the afternoon, because that's how the clinic is staffed. And those hours are very set. And it makes sense in terms of being efficient and running the practice. But for example, we had a radiology clinic that decided, you know what, we're going to staff 7 to 11 instead of 8 to 12, because we have patients that are working women and they want to come in before work and not get stuck in traffic coming in here. Oh, that works great for our female radiologists who also want to come in early. They might, that might be a day that their partner does the daycare drop off. They get in early, but then they can leave early to go home and pick up their kids earlier from daycare. So that would be an example of like a pretty straightforward example of flexibility. And honestly, it's like those little things can make huge differences in the kind of sense of being able to do a great job at your job and also being able to be present for your family.
And I just think about the stress of when you're getting out from work and you have to be across town to pick up your child from daycare before X time. And it is stressful and it carries with you that whole day. You're thinking, how am I going to make this happen? So if there's a way to add that flexibility, you've automatically decreased the stress level for that individual for that day.
Huge, absolutely spot on. And you know, another area, I'm going to mention it because I really worry about our trainees. And many of the female trainees are now having kids during residency. So having flexibility and spaces to be able to pump, and store milk, if that's, you know, what you're doing, those are things that were not available at all when, you know, when I was in my training. I could not have had, I don't think I could have with my personal situation had a child during residency. But lots of women are now doing that, which I think is so fantastic. So creating flexibility and ability to have spaces to pump if that's what, and time to be able to do that. And that's something that there's been a lot of kind of attention to that. And I think that's been great. And so that's another example though of flexibility. I'm going to stand a second on advancement because I think it's really important in the academic space, maybe less so in private practice. And, you know, at Press Ganey, we work with all sorts of organizations. But in the academic setting, being able to advance from a instructor level all the way up the ranks is really important. And that's been traditionally done kind of, there's one track and that's how you go. And so recognizing there needs to be different tracks, that we've got to value the types of work that women are doing, even if it might not be the traditional research, like in this very narrowly defined way. And many organizations have recognized this and created much more innovative ways of thinking about advancement and tracks. So I think that's really important. The Dana-Farber's done a great job on this. They created a kind of career ladder that looked different. Many medical schools are doing this now. And I think that that's really important. Another example of that, when I was still there, was plenty of women had, quote, leadership roles, but they were unpaid because they would, you know, raise their hand and say yes, or somebody would ask them, will you chair this committee? And then what we did was we asked each chair to kind of produce for us a list of those faculty that were in leadership positions and whether the positions were paid or unpaid. And that's really important because at the end of the day, we have to be paying people and compensating them for their time. So that's those are like in the world of advancement. And then respect, and I'm ending with that because right now I think this is the most important one, which is respect. This can be like subtle and not so subtle. So I suspect any female physicians listening to this have had an experience where they were either, if they walked in with their male colleague, even if they were the attending and the male colleague was the medical student, many times a patient might just assume that the male medical student is the attending and the female is the more junior person. And that I know has happened to all of us. Then there's plenty of other examples that are far more challenging that actually might not come from patients at all, but might come from other colleagues, other physicians, other professions within medicine. So addressing these are really important. And as I'm looking now at our data, respect is kind of critical across the entire workforce. It's actually the number one driver for engagement. We can talk about this in a minute. And it is super high up on why people say they want to stay or leave. So if I don't feel respected, my interest in remaining with an organization goes down dramatically versus those people who do feel respected. And I actually think this connects also to all of the work that organizations are doing around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it goes beyond kind of social justice and more into this kind of organizational culture, which is so important.
Yeah, and I've read about the importance of civility in organizations. And there's a great podcast by Adam Grant where he interviews a psychologist who basically says, you know, the worst behavior you accept becomes your culture. And that could be any kind of incivility, right? Whether it's related to gender or some other trait. And that just pervades. And I thought that was, it was so, so interesting to hear about that and recognize the importance of leaders for creating civility and maintaining that.
Okay, so I know I was going to do a little explanation about Press Ganey. Let me do that, but I want to come back to Adam Grant because I am a huge listener of his podcast as well. So Press Ganey, people probably, especially physicians, when they hear the name Press Ganey, actually I'll tell this little story. When I was just leaving the Brigham, I just left the Brigham back in the fall of 2019, and I was doing a talk for a very large Harvard Medical School sponsored kind of women in medicine leadership program. It's actually run by Dr. Julie Silver. And I stood up in front of an audience of like close to 500, mostly women, many physicians, but all other areas of healthcare as well. And my first slide was a disclosure that I was talking about data, using data to understand and address these challenges facing female physicians. But my first slide, I said, I've just moved to Press Ganey. And, you know, it was just kind of saying it as a, just so you guys know. And there was this like negative sucking sound that filled the room. And I know it wasn't just me because I've actually talked to people later and they're like, yeah, I was in that room. It did, you did get like a hiss boo sense going on. So I asked kind of why was I getting that response? Because Press Ganey to me was known for two things. One, patient experience data. So we have for decades been surveying patients and feeding that data back to everybody in healthcare, everybody who's working so that they can improve the experience for patients. And there's phenomenal data now, and we know it, that as important that improving patient experience also impacts clinical outcomes. It also impacts patient outcomes and the experience of the workforce. They're kind of all connected. But in addition to patient experience data, PrescGaini also measures the experience of the workforce and has the largest kind of sole database for people who are working in healthcare. And that's actually why I left the Brigham to go to PrescGaini, was to, as I was leading these efforts at the Brigham and I was running our care innovation work and working with physicians as in my leadership role in the PO, in the physicians organization, what I was also realizing is not just physicians, but everybody was struggling. And there was no way we would ever deliver on our promise to improving care outcomes for patients if we didn't have not just a non-burnt out workforce, but a thriving workforce. Because healthcare is hard. We don't want people to just be okay. We need them to be great. So that was my motivation to leave the Brigham, was to go to PrescGaini to have the availability of data from organizations around the country so that we could learn what was working and not working and then share that so that organizations don't have to reinvent the wheel and we could move forward faster. So that is kind of why I went. So when I am sharing this, I'm at PrescGaini and hearing this negative hiss boo, I wanted to unpack that. And what I learned is nobody besides me thought of PrescGaini as surveying the workforce. They only knew them for patient experience. And they had an experience as females physicians kind of in two ways that were very negative. One was they felt that they were scored more negatively than male physicians, and that that was a bias. And actually, Julie Silver had done research in this in the kind of university setting that even students rate female professors lower than other students, than male professors. So there was this perception that they were being rated lower than their male colleagues. And the data was being weaponized against them. That's how they felt, that the kind of leaders would come and kind of say, hey, Dr. Dudley, why are you not doing more to connect with your patients, or, you know, you're doing, and they were taking it in a very defensive, negative way. I did actually then, and they didn't know that PrescGaini surveyed the workforce at all. So I just told you that story because I want people to think about PrescGaini, not just as the patient experience partner, because we do want to partner with folks, but to really think of us as a human experience platform. And there is no patient experience without strong employee experience. In fact, my colleague who leads our patient experience work at PrescGaini coined the phrase, no HX, no PX, no patient experience without EX, employee experience. So I think that that's really important. We've actually shifted, we call it human experience. And what's fascinating to me is when we go deep into our data, both for patients and the workforce, there's a tremendous set of overlap. What's important to patients is actually also, not that surprisingly, important to those working in healthcare.
I hear this all the time with the women that I coach, because they'll say one of the biggest stressors for them is when they can't provide quality care and when they don't have enough time to really nurture those relationships with patients. And that's exactly what patients are looking for.
Right? Totally. So let's talk about that. So when we, so when I got to PrescGaini, and because I know this is what you're really interested in, is what does our data show? So, and we have like published a little bit of this in Harvard Business Review a couple of years ago, and then we recently reran it. And some of it looks the same and some of it looks a little worse. So, you know, one of the things people are really interested in today is kind of turnover and risk for leaving. And we know that plenty of physicians, many physicians leave not to go to another organization, but they leave to leave healthcare. Or they leave in a less dramatic way. And many female physicians leave by cutting their hours back. And we see that a lot. When we just reran our data recently, female physicians, their intent to stay is much lower than that of male physicians. And it's been trending downward. So like from our most recent set of data, female physicians are rating like their likelihood to stay at a 3.78 and male physicians at a 3.91. And for this data set, a 0.02 is a significant difference.
And is that a scale of 5?
Yes. And that's a big delta between. You mentioned, and we dove deep into trying to understand, like, what are the challenges? What looks different for female versus male physicians? And fortunately or unfortunately, we have actually found these discrepancies in a lot of big areas. So we have found them. We don't measure burnout in the kind of more traditional way of measuring burnout, but we capture it with a metric that we call resilience. It's an 8-question metric. 4 of the questions are about finding activation and meaning and connecting with individuals. 4 of them are about being able to sleep, disconnect from work when you go home, and really being able to recharge. So that set is very consistent with what, you know, Maslach is measuring when it's capturing burnout. We also measure 2 other areas. We measure something that we call engagement. And this is really about pride in the organization. Like, would you send friends and family there? Do you feel like you belong? Do you, you know, if would you want your colleagues to work there? That's our engagement metric. And then we have another metric for physicians, which is about alignment. And this is about how aligned am I and how supported do I feel by the leaders of the organization. So this is not like my direct department chair, if it's an academic center or kind of clinic lead. This is more about my alignment with the organization. So for engagement, alignment, resilience, the decompression part of resilience. So the 4 questions about being able to go home and recover in all of those buckets. And then there's one additional, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion. I didn't mention that, but that's another cluster that we measure. And that's more about like, do I feel like I have equal opportunity for advancement? Am I supported by my colleagues, by my managers, by the organization in doing that? In all of those areas, engagement, alignment, resilience, decompression, and diversity and equity, female physicians, and I can send you the data, are scoring markedly lower than male physicians. And this is from a data set that has about 33,000 male physicians and 30,000 female physicians. And it's based on calendar year 22. So we ran it a year back. The one place where female and male physicians score the same, there is no difference, is this activation, finding meaning and connection and being able to treat patients as individuals. That is spot on the same for female and male physicians. So then when we go deeper, and I think it's important, there is a different experience that female physicians are having at work. And overall, they feel less supported at work. And there's 4 areas that they score lower. One is about feeling like their work unit is appropriately staffed. One is feeling that they have sufficient time for patient care, that they are involved in decisions that affect their work, and that their job stress is reasonable. For those 4 item questions, female physicians score more than 0.21 difference than male physicians. So that's a huge delta. So that is an awakening that we all need to have, that even women, female physicians in the same practice, in the same organization, are having a different experience with staffing in the clinic, with sufficient time for patient care, with being involved in decisions, and for feeling like the stress they're experiencing is reasonable. And then I will tell you that organizations that are diving deeper into this are finding different things. It's not going to be a one size fits all across the board. And what I might experience as a primary care physician may be very different than what a surgeon is experiencing. But you got to dig or you won't find it.
Well, one thing I want to come back and ask you about is that question about staffing. So is that about female physicians receiving different help from the staff that's there? Or is it that they are feeling that there should be more staff for everyone, and they're just feeling that discrepancy or that lack of staff more than their male colleagues? Do you have a sense of which it is?
Okay, great question. And I've had a lot of discussions with folks about this, and I've gotten some answers that have helped me. And I would say the following. I think that in many practices, female physicians get less support from the staff in the practice. Now, this is not globally true, so I don't want to make global generalizations, but I think so. Whether that's because the staff in the clinic feels that me as a female physician, like I got it and I'm very competent and I can multitask, and maybe my male colleague is struggling with that more. If it's a primary care physician practice and I'm doing PAPS, it may be that, you know, the, if it's a female staff in the clinic, and most of the, you know, we know 75% of non-physician healthcare employees are women. So there's a lot of women in more female staff than there are usually male in a clinic setting. So that female staff may go to help the male colleague to do a PAP, or, you know, an exam and be in the room with them. So I do think that I think there is a real experience that female physicians are getting a little less support. Again, this is not globally felt. And we have, when we run the data for different organizations, we don't always find this. But we do find this big delta between male and female physicians in these areas. And I haven't run like this work unit is appropriately staffed for every single organization. Like I haven't looked at it that way, but I suspect it would find its way, given what I'm seeing in this big gap area. I think for sure, and we know it, many female physicians spend more time with their patients. We know that. So that answer of not feeling like they have adequate time is probably very true. And we know that in many cases, female patients take more time and female physicians have more female patients. So we also know that to be true. I've also heard that oftentimes staff in the clinic feel more comfortable going to a female physician in the clinic as a default leader, even if that female leader isn't the kind of physician leader in the practice. The staff often feel more comfortable approaching them with challenges and issues that they might not approach a male physician leader with. And that, again, takes more time away. So those are kind of some examples of that.
This is just fascinating data, absolutely. And it correlates so well with what I see and hear from the women that I speak with. Let's turn our attention to solutions.
Right.
We've mentioned some earlier, especially around flexibility and what organizations and leaders and managers even can do to shift and maybe offer more flexibility. What are some other options? And if you could include too, as an individual at the front line, what might they do to request or advocate for some of these larger changes that are outside of their realm of control?
Great. So I want to focus on both flexibility and respect, because I think they're like so absolutely critical. So for flexibility, this is one of those that like we do have to kind of float all boats here. And I think making this, so I'm a huge advocate, for example, of parental leave, because I do think like the more that this becomes kind of the norm that when, for example, somebody has a child, whether they're the person who birthed the child, or the partner in the relationship, or they adopted, there should be time off to kind of bond, connect, recover, and do that. So I'm a huge advocate of parental leave, and that's a policy that needs to be set, not like a one-off or, you know, what, you know, like we didn't have this. We didn't have not only did I have parental leave, I didn't even have paid maternal leave when I was having my kids. So I'll be really clear, paid parental leave. And that level of a policy, I think that's absolutely critical. If we're going to level the playing field and make it clear that, you know, that creating that type of flexibility is important for everybody, not just for the female physicians, but for all physicians. Flexibility around childcare, I think, is important. Now, this, and I gave you that example earlier of like the radiology clinic starting earlier. I thought that was a great example because it was like win-win for patients and for staff. There are many organizations that are really leaning in to trying to do more to support childcare needs. And I applaud them because I think that this is challenging. And by the way, this goes far beyond physicians. I would actually say like most physicians have far more resources than other women in healthcare. So finding affordable, reliable childcare is huge. So I think the more that organizations are willing to figure out flexibility around that, and some support for that, I think that that's great. I think that's a big step. And I don't know how successful all organizations will be in that. So I think more flexibility around scheduling parental leave. And I think the way to do this is to do it by policy so that it doesn't feel like you're giving somebody a favor or that they feel like they can't ask for it. Like, we want to get rid of that. So it has to start like at the top. And again, that's part of why I think having more women in leadership is really important and having more allies, whether they're women or not, in leadership is really important. So that's examples. Those are examples of some of the flexibility pieces. I think we've come a long way with the pandemic, right? People used to, when I was still at the Brigham pre-pandemic, the expectation was is even if you were doing research on your research day, you needed to be doing it in your office setting, even if you were on a computer. That has totally changed. And I think that there is this acknowledgement that you can actually be productive at home. So there's far more flexibility and acceptance of that. And I think that that's fantastic. I think flexibility with like meetings and having a virtual option is also, so all of these flexibility things, I think, are kind of maturing and they were almost non-existent. So that's good. And like even things like telehealth and doing virtual visits or hybrid work settings, all of these are examples. And we're thinking a lot about this and at Prescani and looking into the data a lot about this. And it kind of ultimately falls into this bigger bucket, I would say, respect, psychological safety, and something that we call social capital, which is like our relationships with one another. This is, you know, organizations are eking out every little last drip of financial savings that they can. They have to. And good news, like we have CFOs who are managing that, and COOs who are managing operational efficiency. That's great. We have a lot of folks who over the last few years have really thought about human capital, right? This is the burnout. How do I better support individuals so that they can, and whether that's, you know, some flexibility in schedules, making sure people take their time off, things that make them individually more healthy, having peer support programs, changing the optics that it's okay to take care of yourself first. In fact, you have to. That's about human capital. But social capital is really about the relationships and how we interact with one another. And this is where I feel like we really need to be focusing now. Like, medicine is a team sport. That means like leaders have to know how to lead and lead. And a lot of physicians, so physicians by default are leaders. They're going to be leaders in any setting that they're in, even when they don't feel like they're a leader. But we haven't trained them. I mean, some of them we've trained, but a lot of times leaders become leaders because they were really good at patient care or they were really good at research. But did they ever like learn skills of leadership? So intentionally investing in leadership to develop leaders is huge. And I think it's a huge part of social capital. When I was at the Brigham, we designed a female coaching program. And I used an external group to come in and help coach up our women so that they could develop faster. So I think that that's hugely important. Back to your Adam Grant comment earlier. So Adam Grant has a great TED radio from a couple years ago. It's 37 minutes and it's called, Is It Safe to Speak Up at Work? And in that show, he interviews both Amy Edmondson, who has like done all of this research, especially in healthcare. She's at Harvard Business School. She actually happens to be married to the dean of the Harvard Medical School as well. So she's very, you know, aware of challenges facing all of medicine. And he also interviews Admiral Bill McRaven, who wrote this Make Your Bed book and did this amazing UT Austin commencement speech address a number of years ago. And he also interviews a guy from Boeing who noticed all of these things that were going wrong with the planes, but leaders were not enabling him to feel safe speaking up and speaking out. So I'm sharing this because I think it's on all of us, even when we as physicians may feel less comfortable feeling safe speaking up and speaking out. It is on us to create that environment for others around us. And, you know, Amy Edmondson is a great framework for thinking about this, for really recognizing that, and Adam Grant does this too, like we try to be perfect. It's good to try to be, to improve every day, but perfection is pretty impossible in the types of work that we do. So figuring out to recognize that and frame, yes, we are going for like zero harm. And then when it happens, we can't beat up each other. We have to actually thank the messenger, embrace the messenger. And the way we can do that as leaders is to better model vulnerability. I am not perfect. I make mistakes too, so that other people feel comfortable speaking up and speaking out. So I'm sharing this because I'm really focused on this opportunity for physicians in medicine to really focus on social capital. How do we create better teams? How do we then engender respect? And we have to look for it because different pockets of the workforce feel very differently about respect. And women feel markedly less respected than many others in the workforce. Minorities often feel less respected than others in the workforce. People with disabilities often feel less respected than others in the workforce. And we know, like from our most recent data, that when I don't feel respected, I am far more likely to leave, and I am orders of magnitude less likely to be engaged.
Jessica, wow, that is such important information, and especially the emphasis you're putting on organizations and leadership and development of leaders to be strong, effective leaders. And physicians are part of that. Is there one pearl that you'd like to leave? I'm thinking about the individual listener who may be saying, yes, yes, I agree with all of this. Now, what do I do? Do you have one suggestion for that listener?
Great question. I think I'm going to say two things. So the first thing I would say is, and I mentioned it, but it's so important, like you have to take care of yourself first. And it is really important. And like, while I think we've gotten better at doing that, it actually means not just making the time, but it means for some of us, like rewiring and not blaming ourselves when things don't go right. And this is why part of like trying to stop shooting for perfect, kind of give yourself a break. So I think that that's one thing. And I would add to that, as a female leader, you know, we set our bars super high. I'm not saying don't set the bar high, but I'm saying like, be okay. If you don't, like if you fail, it's okay. Like, you know, I think we are our worst critics, and figuring out how we get to a better space with that is really important. That's point one. I know you said one thing, but I'm going to go for two. The second is, when I talk to people about like what they love about still being a physician or for employees still being in healthcare, what do you think is like the number one thing that they say that they really love about their jobs?
Well, for me, it was the sense of meaning that I got from the interaction with the patient.
So that is absolutely, and I would say like a huge percentage of people say that. And then when we probe a little further, the other thing that they like the best about their job is their relationships with their colleagues. And we've lost that a little bit with COVID. So I think we all need to think, and this goes to this social capital piece too, how do we kind of reclaim, and if we didn't have it before, make it, this opportunity to kind of connect. And it shouldn't just be with other physicians, but with, you know, there's nurse man, if I'm a leader, a physician leader, there are nurse managers, there's administrative leaders. How do I create more of a relationship with them for this like bigger, broader picture that it is a team sport, you know, and we are only going to be as strong as all of us together. So that would be my second message is we get strength from our colleagues and our relationships with others. How do we become a little bit more intentional about making sure that's still happening, even when we may be more hybrid than we used to be?
Jessica, thank you so much for this conversation. I feel like I have learned and been, again, intrigued by the data and your interpretation of it and where we can take it and the potential solutions. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Diane, thank you so much for creating the opportunity for me to come on and for all the work you're doing to raise awareness and help people solve these problems. So thank you.